Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes.
Welcome to Court Appointed, QD's perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer dude and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
Well, 2021's off to a wild start, Tommy.
Yeah, you know, if we were all like, well, 2020's over. That's good. Glad 2020's over. 2021's looking pretty good. And we made it to January 6th, and it went to hell.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy day yesterday, watching all the things that happened at the Capitol.
It's something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, I'll tell you that. And, you know, the thing that outrages me is the police seemed completely incapable of doing anything. It's like, oh, well, look out, here they come. And they just backed out of the way and opened the door.
Yeah, and it's bizarre. It's like they weren't even ready.
Yeah, in the Black Lives Matter protests, you didn't see that. You saw them coming at the protesters aggressively and, you know, with guns and smoke bombs and everything else.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on or why they weren't ready, but I imagine somebody's going to be in a little bit of trouble or some hot water over that.
Well, you know, I thought maybe they just didn't have enough people there, enough help. But if it was just the Capitol Police alone, I was surprised to learn there's 2,300 of them.
Yeah.
2,300 Capitol Police. So if they were there, which they should have been, I mean, Trump, you know, telegraphed this is what was going to happen. He's been stirring them up and calling for this for 2 weeks. So this shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about it. It was pretty bizarre. I was sitting in my office watching it on my phone as it unfolded, because I was watching the Electoral College vote, and you know, all of a sudden it got suspended. I was like, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I didn't get very much work done after that.
No, that was just a travesty. I just couldn't believe it. And they just ran around the halls like it was okay. It was like, it was all right to be in there doing that. That was their right to be there. When does anybody ever get near the Capitol or the White House that there isn't a strong police presence to instantly track them down, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think there's going to be a lot of prosecutions coming from it. There's so much video evidence. I mean, and they were pretty brazen about it, too. Like, posts on social media, like, you know, with their feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk and, you know.
They were proud of what they accomplished. They weren't hiding with it. They didn't. In their minds, it was right. If we can get in here and we can change their minds by force with guns or whatever. There was pipe bombs they found in there after they dispersed the crowd. Can you imagine what would have happened if those had gone off?
Oh, it's scary. Very scary. But we talked about doing an episode about this, but we already had another one ready to go, so we decided to stick with the one that we had kind of talked about beforehand, which is a bit more lighthearted.
Yeah, but we just couldn't let this pass without mentioning it. I mean, you hear the 25th Amendment thrown around, and we went over that in one of our other episodes about how that takes place with the vice president and the majority of the cabinet. We're basically removing the president from office because he's unfit for duty, which I would think this qualifies, but none of them have the balls to do it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if there's going to be time left in his administration. I mean, there's not very much time left, but, you know, I would think that would be kind of an important thing to happen based on what took place.
Well, the main thing is keep him off of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and I guess he hates TikTok, so he won't go on that one, and give him any press coverage.
Can we take away the football?
Take away the football?
Yeah, the nuclear football.
Oh, it has
the codes.
Really? This is the guy that's got his finger on the button?
Yeah, I'm a little worried about that.
Yeah. Are there no adults in the room? Where are the adults? Is this in The Simpsons, or no, not The Simpsons, in Family Guy, and the son there, I need an adult. I need an adult.
Yeah.
We need an adult.
Where are the grown-ups? Well, this episode, we decided to talk about some famous sports frauds. I was on the internet, as I am occasionally, and I came across an interesting article about an infamous NASCAR driver named L.W. Wright. And after reading that article about that, I thought, this sounds like something that I had never heard of this before. And I thought, this sounds like something that I think we should talk about on our podcast. So
my brother's a big NASCAR fan. He always goes to Talladega 500s, things like that. Me, I have never been to a race car event and never planned to go to one. And I just kind of know some of the names of some of the top ones, or I used to. I don't think I really even know any of them anymore.
Yeah, I know it just in passing. I'm definitely not a NASCAR fan. I don't really think I ever was a NASCAR fan. I've watched a race here or there. I've never been to one, although I would like to go to one. I mean, it seems pretty interesting. I've been to some other kinds of races. I went to like Le Mans road course type races and before down at Sebring, Florida. And it was pretty interesting, but the NASCAR seems a little bit less fun to me because they're just kind of going in a circle. But
did you ever see any of those races at the end that somebody that lost said it was a rigged race and that they demanded that that they win because they knew it was rigged, even though they could offer no evidence?
Usually they have evidence.
You know, the most interesting thing that I know about NASCAR, or at least it's interesting to me, is you know how NASCAR got started, right?
Yeah, they're bootleggers.
Yeah, bootleggers and moonshiners that were running their whiskey out of there. And they were running, they'd soup up these cars so they could outrun the police and everything to get their load delivered. And eventually the good old boys got together and formed NASCAR. And that's kind of the roots of it. And some of the first early drivers actually were bootleggers and got into it. I don't think you have any around still, but
No, it's gone corporate now.
Yeah. Yeah. But I thought that was always interesting to me that that's how they got started. I don't know if you remember an old movie that, Last American Hero.
Not the movie.
Yeah. Well, there was a movie, The Last American Hero. And it was about a guy that came out of moonshine and then went into NASCAR. It's actually a true story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And had that Jim Croce song in it, I Got a Name.
Is it from the 70s?
Yeah.
A little bit before my time, before my movie viewing experience.
I want to say Bo Bridges was in it, but that's probably wrong because it had to have been somebody older, I would think.
Well, this story takes place around, the original story at least, takes place around 1982. So it's a little bit after that kind of time period and after it had kind of gone straight a little bit, but it was still kind of in its infancy. It wasn't as big of a deal as it was, or as it is now, rather. So it all started when there was an announcement in a Nashville newspaper, which was phoned in by a resident of Henderson, Tennessee. So I guess back in the day, you could phone in press releases to newspapers and they might publish them. And it read, Nashville driver L.W. Wright yesterday announced he will be attempting to qualify for next week's Winston 500 Grand National Race at Talladega, Alabama. The 33-year-old Wright, a veteran of 45 Grand National Races, will drive a 1981 Monte Carlo. The name of Wright's team is Music City Racing, and among his sponsors are country music stars Merle Haggard and T.G. Shepherd. Haggard is scheduled to appear at Talladega with the driver. So that, you know, is a press release in the paper. So it sounds, pretty legit. This must be some kind of veteran driver who's starting a new team. He's got sponsorship from some kind of famous country music stars here in Nashville. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. But the weird thing was, is that no one really knew who this guy was. No one could remember hearing of L.W. Wright, even though he had said he had been in all these different grand national type races before. But whatever, you know, if he had Merle Haggard and T.G. Shepherd as sponsors and all this, like, you know, he must be legit, right?
Right. And then they added, but as long as he could participate if he had his $115 fee for the NASCAR competition license and the $100 entry fee.
That's right, because there are right-to-work laws which required NASCAR to let any driver participate if they could pay that fee.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically, if he pays the fee and whatever, then we'll let him in. So L.W. Wright wrote this, wrote out the checks for $115 for his license, $100 for his entry fee, and he wrote checks for up to $1,000 for extra pit passes for his crew. So he's doing it right. But there's one major problem. At this point, he didn't actually have a car, so he had to go to obtain one.
Oh, so, man, a car would help.
It's kind of an important piece of the NASCAR race. So using this press release, Wright went and talked to B.W. Bernie Terrell, who was the president of Space Age Marketing. And Terrell agreed to buy and sponsor a race car for Wright. And again, he had passed himself to him off as a veteran driver. And he gave Wright $30,000 in cash to buy a car, in addition to another $7,500 for expenses. And he gave him some sort of tractor-trailer rig to pull the car along with. So when you're looking at this money, that's actually $100,000 when it's adjusted for 2020's inflation.
And so he just walked in off the street, didn't know the guy, and the guy talked him into just giving him that, the $40,000 plus the truck.
Yeah, I mean, just based on the fact this guy had Merle Haggard, T.G. Shepard as his sponsors, and he was a veteran NASCAR driver. So, and this is the important thing here too, and I want to talk about this a little bit later about some other stories, is this is before data was really shared on the internet pretty fluently and quickly. You couldn't just Google this guy and find out if he was telling the truth or not.
Right.
So, I mean, you kind of had to take people at their word a bit more, or just judge their character. So.
It always amazes me the nerve of some of these con artists that they go in and they say these things and they can just convince people and they're charming and they instill confidence in them and they walk out with their cash. And I couldn't do that. I mean, I would fold. If I went in to do that, I'd eventually go, oh, I'm just kidding. Never mind.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. Yeah, I couldn't do that.
So after he got the money, he went and talked to Sterling Marlin, who was an actual legitimate NASCAR driver and kind of a famous NASCAR driver. And
I've heard of him.
Yeah, me too. He purchased a Monte Carlo for $20,000, $700, $17,000 of which was cash. And he agreed to serve as Wright's crew chief because Marlin kind of supposedly knew something was a little odd. He wanted to see what was going to happen. So he wrote him a check for the balance of it.
Straight cash, homie.
That's right. He also wrote checks to Goodyear, $1,500 for tires, $1,200 for another driver for parts, and $168 for team jackets. Because you got to look good if you're gonna do the part. You got to have team jackets, right?
That's right. To fulfill the con, you got to have the racing jackets.
So as the race drew a little bit closer, and Wright had an interview again, he name dropped Haggard and Shepard, but there's only one problem. Shepard actually heard the interview and said that he had never heard of the guy. And his tax attorney released a statement that said that something fishy is going on somewhere. And as the race drew even closer, and Wright was confronted about this on the race weekend, and he kind of shook it off, kind of calmly said, well, he may have been a little premature about announcing that. But it was in the works. It was going to happen. And even though no one remembered him from the other Grand National races, he said, well, actually, I raced the sportsman class. I just fudged a little bit. I didn't, was trying to embellish just a little bit. No big lie there. I was just kind of, trying to make myself look a little bit better. My bad, guys. You caught me there. And so, they said, well, okay, that sounds legitimate.
But he knew all the right things to say,
He did.
Oh, I may have been premature. Well, I was in a different class. He knew all those things to say. That's what I'm saying. The first time I had to face one of those, I'd fold.
Yeah. So they did the qualifying run, which is what they do before the race actually starts. And he qualified at 187 miles per hour. although he did crash into the wall on his second lap, but he went really, really fast.
Right into the wall.
So he started in 36th place on the race day. And he actually lasted 13 laps before his engine blew up. And he earned $1,545 in prize money because another driver actually crashed before him. So technically, he did not lose and did not finish in last place. So here's the funny thing.
That's a heck of a career he established.
He just disappeared and vanished. The car was left abandoned at the track, and he was never seen again. And then, of course, the checks started bouncing.
Every one of them.
Not one check he wrote. His phone bill, his rent, or anything actually was able to be paid. The police searched for Wright, but to this day, no one really knows who he was. He just got away scot-free.
He's like D.B. Cooper of NASCAR.
Pretty much. I mean, I had never heard of this story before. This is screaming for a movie. I mean, I'm just telling you.
Yeah. It's still an unsolved mystery. Nobody knows what became of him or where he went. I'm sure T.L. Wright was probably not even his real name.
Oh, you know? No way.
But so they didn't check that close in those days. They didn't have any way to do that. So, you know, you just get a fake driver's license that says that. That was probably good enough.
Yeah, he had all the forged information and everything. Here's the amazing thing to me about this is, like, this guy was definitely a gifted con artist, right?
Right.
He had gotten away with essentially $100,000 in today's money. But rather than just get away with the money and walk away with it, he said that wasn't good enough for him. He actually wanted to be a NASCAR driver. He wanted to go fast. He wanted to turn some laps. And so he did. I mean, imagine the mindset of this guy.
Yeah, because when the guy gave him the nearly $40,000 in a truck, he should have just left with that and never showed up again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, zero chance he would have been caught.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
but bizarre. You're right. I think he wanted the thrill of the race. I think that he must have had an interest in NASCAR, and that's what drove him to concoct this whole plan, because he had to have known it to be able to say the right things that he said and to know how everything worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely amazing. So
they did say he asked a lot of questions that anyone that had raced would already know. So that made some of the other people suspicious about him too.
Yeah. Like, this guy seems a little bit off kilter here. What's up?
Now, do we turn right the whole time or left? I forget.
So you had some other NASCAR stories, did you not?
Well, yeah, because I didn't have the text with me when I started doing my research, so I didn't remember. I remembered you said it was NASCAR fraud, so I started looking up NASCAR fraud to try to figure out which one you were talking about, and I didn't even find that one at first. It wasn't until I talked to you later and got the 1982 part that it happened that I got that. But evidently, NASCAR, I guess because of all the money, is fraught with fraud. It's fraught with fraud. It has it everywhere.
Some absolute alliteration.
Yeah. You've heard of Kurt Busch before, I guess.
Yeah.
He had a girlfriend named Patricia Driscoll, and she was found guilty on two counts each of wire fraud and tax evasion, and additionally one count of fraud. Driscoll was the president of the Armed Forces Foundation. The organization was designed to accept charity donations that would help military families. The organization was deeply rooted within the NASCAR community, and she was Kurt Busch's girlfriend.
Hmm.
So she was collecting all this money and their foundation would make the representation that 95% of the donations would go to benefit military members and their families. And instead, she used more than $500,000 of the charity foundation revenue to fund her extravagant personal life. Jewelry, alcohol, and other items were paid for using funds from the foundation instead of using those funds to help military families. And then, in addition, she would pay herself $3,000 per month to go for items like her car, gas, and her cell phone.
Yeah, just the essentials.
Yeah. So she did end up being put in jail. For where she was found guilty to one count of fraud and had to serve 1 year and 1 day. However, it went to an appeals court and they overturned it because there was one person holding out that kept saying that she wasn't guilty. And the judge, evidently trying to override this one guy, kept changing the instructions to the jury and actually used some phraseology apparently that wasn't really legal or correct.
Mm.
So when they reviewed it later, they said, well, that judge, you know, forced that on that juror. So they threw out the conviction. And I think by then it had been a couple years and they didn't really see the need to pursue it. She had paid back the money in restitution. She had to pay part of the money back. So they, at that point, just let it go.
It's funny how paying restitution seems to make things all right. So that's one of the problems when you have these fraud cases where people owe money. You can put them in prison, but then if they're in prison, they can't make money to actually repay the restitution. So it's kind of what's the real purpose here? Are we trying to make the victim whole, or are we trying to punish the person? So
yeah, that's right. And getting the money back is a major thing. That's the same way with embezzlement a lot of times. You see them go real light on people that commit embezzlement. They don't serve much jail time as long as they're agree to pay the money back.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Now, here is another one that's also related to Kyle Busch in a way. It makes me wonder about that. But this guy is a guy named Robert Boston, and he was fraudulently luring investors so in part he could fund his son Justin's racing career. It said that he was found guilty by a 12-member jury on charges of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, securities fraud, and money laundering. He conned investors to pour money into a new startup business that he had. It was a computer recycling center named Zloop. Z-L-O-O-P. Never heard of it. Zloop.
It's a great name.
And, he didn't tell people. He was trying to get them to invest, saying, you know, showing them these portfolios of how they were going to make millions of dollars and everything. But then he was turning around and he was pumping the money into, like, you got to have $6 million apparently to put up to race in NASCAR nowadays.
Yeah, no, so, it's a far cry from the $115 license and the $100 entry fee.
So he was fronting that $6 million for his son to race. Now, the son never knew anything about it.
Yeah.
But what this guy, to defend himself, said was, hey, look, that was our strategy. You can't convict me of being a bad businessman and having a bad business strategy. My strategy was we were going to spend all this money on marketing. So they were spending like over $6 million on marketing, and their revenues were only like $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So they were saying, well, we had a bad business model. But that was how he was trying to get out of the fraud. But
right.
I say that it was related to Kyle Busch. It said that Robert Boston did not testify in his defense, and he argued that racing was always part of the marketing plan, and it was obvious to investors. Zloop, according to testimony during the trial, paid $4.9 million directly to race teams Kyle Busch Motorsports, Joe Gibbs Racing, and Venturini Motorsports, and more than $6 million total when including seats and other items.
Wow. That's big money.
Yeah. So, you know, that's he also used some of the money to purchase seats and suites at the NFL's Carolina Panthers, as well as Bristol Speedway, Kentucky Speedway, and Pocono Raceway.
Hmm.
So, you know, they basically said he set up that whole foundation because he was a NASCAR junkie or something.
Yeah. Do you know where West Virginia Speedway is?
No, I don't think I've ever heard of that. You're not talking about the one at Milton, I hope.
Yeah.
That dirt track out there.
The one in Nona.
Is that it?
Yeah, it was actually called West Virginia Speedway at one point.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I knew they had a dirt track out there, but I didn't know that it had a name that makes it sound so grand.
Yeah.
There was another one that was Angela Harkness, and she actually moved here from Iran, and she ran several scams on people. She was a stripper for a while, and then she met up with a guy named Jones that was a Wells Fargo vice president. So she got him to leave his wife and come live with her, and then she suggested that they form a new minority-owned NASCAR team, which would attract multi-million dollar sponsorships. So purchasing cars from Robert Yates Racing, the two assembled a championship-caliber team in crew chief Harold Holly, general manager Clyde McLeod, and popular driver Mike McLaughlin. The team made its debut at the season-closing Ford 300 in the NASCAR Busch Series. But it ends up Jones and Harkness could not produce the $6 million they needed to remain in business, and their checks begin to bounce. Harkness threatened their sponsor, which was WiredFlyer.com, a now defunct Austin-based internet travel agency, to pay $350,000 or face legal action. Jones and Harkness ended up fleeing the country, and the team dissolved after the season-opening race. Well, that's to say, there's so much money involved in this. And, you know, you see the cars, and they've got those stickers all over them with all the different names and all that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. There's a lot of money changing hands.
And there's always that joke that the all the different politicians should have stickers on them like NASCAR.
Hey, you're right. Yeah, for all the lobbyists that they entertain and do their bidding for and everything. I agree. This last one, this is kind of like just the opposite of NASCAR as far as it being there for fraud. This guy, he's an inmate, sues and claims that NASCAR made him do it. In the How NASCAR Changed My Life department, a federal prison inmate has filed a $23 million lawsuit claiming that NASCAR is responsible for his criminal ways in felonies ranging from speeding to credit card fraud. His latest lawsuit, one of hundreds to date, states that watching NASCAR races influenced him to speed, doing 135 miles an hour and getting tickets. Not only did NASCAR influence him to speed, but NASCAR addiction drove him further into a life of crime by pushing him to use illegally obtained credit cards to support his habit. He said, "I used Kyle Petty's Discover card to buy Mark Martin Viagra," according to the complaint. Obviously, a little out of touch with the times, as Viagra hasn't sponsored Martin since the end of the 2005 season. His NASCAR addiction led him to buy race tickets using credit cards he knew to be fraudulent, but the defendants insisted they did not care and encouraged me to buy Budweiser beer and funnel cake with more stolen funds.
Beer and funnel cake?
Yeah. Finally, he claims that Jeff Gordon's DuPont-sponsored car poisoned me with DuPont chemicals. I pray this court will grant my motions for relief. I don't want to die in prison.
Well, this guy's a creative writer.
Yeah, it says he sued Jeff Gordon and Hendrick Motorsports, alleging that Gordon conspired with Barry Bonds and Michael Vick and others to drive his life insane, create madness in the world, and use the number 24 as a weapon of mass destruction.
Man, that's an interesting lawsuit. Yeah. Well, people have access to the courts, so there's going to be some people that file some things that are a little bit off the wall.
He claims that Jeff Gordon once tied him to the bumper during a Talladega race and took Kit from Knight Rider and used his number 24 car in illegal car fights at Jiffy Lube Express.
Well, that's just getting to the nonsensical at that point.
Yeah, he's lost it.
Kit would never do that.
The Hoff wouldn't let him, would he?
No, don't hassle the Hoff. So the last story that I have is it's not really out and out fraud, but it's a bit more of a grift that this one soccer player had. And there's a documentary called Kaiser, the greatest footballer never to play football. And it's a documentary, and you know how I love a good documentary.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I do love soccer as well. And this is about a Brazilian soccer player whose abilities were pretty much below that of a professional soccer player. But back in the late 1970s, early 80s, he was a highly sought-after player in Brazil. So his nickname was Kaiser, supposedly, as he said, due to his resemblance to Franz Beckenbauer, who was a very famous German footballer at the time when he was young, although his friends said it was actually because he looked more like a bottle of Kaiser beer. Kaiser beer is a Brazilian beer brand.
How do you look like a bottle of beer?
I don't know. but Carlos Kaiser, he started his youth career at Botafogo, which is a very kind of famous Brazilian soccer team. And then he moved to Flamengo. And in 1979, he impressed some scouts of Pueblo in a Mexican league at a training session and was signed by the Mexican club, although he was released months after without even playing a single match for them. So what he would do is, I mean, he did play soccer a little bit early on, but not very much after that, mainly when he was kind of younger. So his trick was he would make friends with the influential people. He would befriend the powerful figures like the owners, the coaches, different star players, and tell them about his impressive football career and his pedigree. And sometimes he would go up to the different journalists around the soccer teams, players, and he would basically construct a web of lies that were super elaborate so nobody could really remember what he had said in the first place, because there were just so many different lies that he was telling, but they all kind of made a little bit of sense. And the bottom line was everybody really liked him. He was a really nice guy and fun to be around. So nobody really cared that much.
Like Ted Lasso, huh?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And so, like I said, before the internet, nobody was really the wiser. You couldn't really Google to see any footage of this guy. There wasn't much out there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people just kind of liked him, and he was basically great at marketing himself to the different people.
And I mean, there's no sense picking up the phone and calling the last team he said he played for and checking, is there?
Bebeto, he was the World Cup winning striker in 1994, said his chat was so good that if you let him open his mouth, that would be it. He'd charm you. You couldn't avoid it. That would be it. So the guy was a great, you know, real fast talker and really good. And he was also in great shape, too. Like when you see this documentary, if you watch it, like he's a good looking, attractive guy, super fit. And he looked like he looked the part. He looked like a football player, but he didn't have any skills was the problem. And
that's right. It's better to look good than to feel good.
And so what he would generally do is he would sign a contract, and then basically he would say, well, I can't play just yet because I haven't played much lately. I need to do some training, some physical training first before I can get into match shape. And so he would spend the first few weeks only doing the physical training, like sprints and running and pull-ups and things like that, which he could do fine. He was, like I said, he was in great shape.
Right.
But then towards the end of the physical portion, he would always feign some sort of injury. His favorite one would be a hamstring injury. He'd usually say, oh, I pulled the hamstring. I can't play. And it's a shame, too, because I was really getting fit now.
I heard the pop. There went the hammy.
Yeah. And so back then, the medical technology with x-rays and things like that, you couldn't determine if somebody actually had an injury or not. So,
yeah, soft tissue.
Yeah, so he actually had a dentist who claimed that he had a focal infection whenever any club wanted to go any further. So he had one doctor who would say, you know, he's got some issues. So by following these steps, he would manage to stay a few months at the various clubs just training without ever being exposed as a fraud. He even had a toy mobile phone that was not real, which allowed him to accidentally be overheard by club officials as he was turning down approaches from other clubs across the world. And sometimes he would actually speak in English to try to convince them, because they didn't speak English, until one person who actually spoke English overheard him and said, nah, this guy's full of it. So he had a fake phone. So, you know, back then they didn't really have cell phones. So he was like, you know, oh, who is this? Oh, no, I can't come play for you. I'm hurt here at so-and-so. I want to play for them. So, you know, it kind of added to this whole mystique about him. And so a lot of times he would end up hanging around the club, and he kind of become a morale specialist. He was a lot of fun. He'd always go out to the clubs with all the players and arrange to have all the girls around and all the parties. And like I said, everyone really liked him. So everyone's like, oh, you know, whatever. But eventually the gig kind of caught up to him a little bit. And so none of the clubs in Brazil really wanted to have him around. So in 1985, he peddled his scam to Europe, and supposedly joined the French Division II team, Gazelic Ajaccio, where a friend of his was playing. So he supposedly went over there. Now, it's kind of not really known whether he actually did play over there or not. There's not much of a record of it. But supposedly, at the presentation, the club arranged a training session with the fans so he could, you know, go out and kick the ball around and play or whatever. And he was afraid of being caught, so he kicked all the balls into the crowd while kissing the club's badge, and he said, "Oh, I was passing those out as souvenirs to everyone, and there were no balls left for him to play with."
Hey, you got to think quick if you're going to be a scam artist.
Oh yeah. So, but there's also some report that he actually never even went over to France to play, and that instead he was just actually photographed wearing the jersey by one of his friends. And they took the photographs and used that fake jersey to show where he was playing abroad before he came back to Brazil. And that was his proof of his time playing in France. Again, before the internet, so no way to prove it.
Sure.
And also the language barrier. So he turns to Brazil, and he gets signed by another club in 1986. This club is called Bangu. And this is not as big as the other ones, like Flamengo and the other ones I mentioned. So he's kind of going down tier. So he started at kind of the top and is kind of working his way down. And he started using his fake injury scam there again. And the only problem was that club was owned by this gentleman named Castor DeAndre. And he was Brazil's premier bachirio, someone who has an illegal gambling ring.
Oh.
And so a lot of times during that era, he was described as the most dangerous man in Brazil.
Mm.
So
you don't want to cross him, huh?
No, that's a pretty dangerous person.
Yeah.
Plus, he was really good friends with the FIFA president at the time. And mm-hmm. FIFA is the governing body of soccer. So
right.
this owner was also good friends with FIFA. So the story goes that this Castor DeAndre, the owner, at one point, he chased a referee around the field with a gun, trying to talk to him about one of the calls he made at one point. So he was kind of a bad dude. You don't want to mess with this guy.
Sounds like he was a MAGA guy.
Yeah. But, you know, so Kaiser.
He was trying to change the outcome of that election.
So he gets all the hype about Kaiser, and he has a newspaper headline filed, "Gangu has its king," with Kaiser's picture on it. So they thought Kaiser was going to be their star center forward.
You know,
he's going to come there and play for him. So Castor, he actually, even though Kaiser did this fake injury scam thing again and never played for them, this Castor guy actually loved him because, again, he was so much fun to be around. He was at the parties. You know, he was always at the club, arranging all the fun, everything like that. And so he was there for a while. And then one weekend, he got the call while he was at a club at 4 a.m. And word reached him that Castor had sent an order for him to be on the bench that next day. So he's like, "Hey, you need to be on the bench the next day." And Kaiser panicked before being reassured by the coach that he would probably be a non-playing substitute. He could just ride the pine. He wouldn't have to play.
Yeah.
So Bangu was playing that game, and they were off to a horrible start. They were down 2-0, and Castor sent a message down from the stands via walkie-talkie
to
the coach and said, "Put in our star." So Kaiser basically had two choices. He could go on as a substitute, where they would quickly see that he was not who he said he was.
Or run for his life.
Yeah, or he could refuse to go on, in which case this guy might actually kill him.
Yeah.
So he improvised his third option. While warming up, Kaiser heard an opposing fan call him a long-haired name and also some other things. And so he looked up at the guy and had an idea went off, a spark. He used it as an excuse to start a brawl with the away supporters. He jumped in the stand and started a fist fight with this guy. And so the referee comes over after seeing this and grabs Kaiser and gives him a red card and sends him off so he can't even come in the game.
That's some quick thinking.
He is a quick thinker.
Yeah.
So after the game, the owner summons him and he's like, "What in the world is wrong with you? You know, why did you fight this guy?" And Kaiser looks him straight in the eye and says, "God has taken both my parents away, but gave me another father, you, who they accused of being a crook," he sniffed. "So I lost it and went for them. But don't you worry, because my contract is up in a week and I'll be off." So basically he was saying, "I'll just get out of your hair. I'll leave you alone. Just
I
please
won't bring
don't
you shame."
Castor actually gave him a pay raise and a contract extension after that happened. Because he loved him so much. I mean, this documentary is amazing. It's crazy this guy was able to pull this off for this long.
That's like that movie it was out a while back with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, that one. And that guy was only supposed to be like 17 or something like that.
Yeah,
and he was doing those things.
It's a great book, too. One more thing about Kaiser, though. If you look at his Wikipedia page, he actually played up until 1990.
Wow.
And if you look at his like little stat sheet for the different teams he played for and appearances and things like that, there's a zero appearances listed for him on all those teams.
He never played a minute, huh?
It doesn't look like it, no.
But he traveled around and played on bunches of different teams and got paid.
Yeah, and lived an amazing life.
That's unbelievable. That's what I say. If you got the nerve, you can pull that kind of stuff off. I couldn't live like that, though. That'd be nerve-wracking to me.
I think you'd have a hard time doing it in this day and age.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't do that. There's too much way to check people and stuff like that.
You would have to build up some sort of like a electronic CV or something on the computer, on the internet, so to show that to back this up, because people can Google things too quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to CGI yourself into games and stuff.
Yeah, that's what you need to do. Be some sort of graphic engineer, graphic designer, so you could do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that Kaiser story, it's on Amazon Prime, so it's free if you have Prime. It's an interesting watch. So
that's unbelievable. Well, you know, during this pandemic, we've gotten a chance to watch a whole lot of documentaries, huh?
Oh, yeah. I've watched a lot of documentaries, a lot of TV, caught up on a lot of different things.
I watched one on Richard Jewell a couple weeks ago. That was a really good one.
I wanted to watch that one. That's like a whole series, isn't it?
Well, it's just eight episodes, I think.
Yeah.
But it's really good. I mean, you know, that what they did to him, they just ruined his life by the way that they, you know, falsely accused him. And he was never charged. He was never arrested. But yet everybody in the country felt he was the guy that did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the FBI ignored information that cleared him and ignored other suspects that the ATF brought to him because the FBI was all ego-driven about they were in charge and they weren't going to listen to somebody from ATF.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the classic weenie measuring contest.
Yeah. Yeah, and they were all a bunch of weenies.
Well, it feels good to be back on the air here in 2021.
Yeah, we had a nice little break, but it's time to go back to work now.
I guess so. Well, I didn't really prepare any legal briefs for this episode because we didn't really talk about too many different legal things.
Hmm.
The interesting thing there, which we've already kind of talked about time and time again, was the phrase kiting, which is what L.W. Wright did.
Yeah, with his checks.
There was checks. So basically he would write a check and before it could clear, he was on to the next one. So, but like you said, you can't do that anymore because basically it's withdrawn almost automatically once you present a check.
Yeah. They do imaging now. They image all the checks as they take them in and then just send them directly to the bank then.
Yeah. So not a huge legal type episode, but we talked about some interesting characters out there.
Yeah, and if you're ever anybody approaches you about investing in NASCAR, you might think twice or at least double check your sources.
Would you like to invest in my NASCAR team? Well, sure. What's your credentials? I want to go fast.
That's all you have to do is run fast and drive fast and turn left.
That's right.
That would be fun, though. I wouldn't mind doing that.
Yeah, would you want to go 187 miles an hour in a 1981 Monte Carlo?
Sure, who cares? I went almost that fast in a 1968 Pontiac Tempest.
Did you?
Yeah, the speedometer would register up to 135, and it wouldn't go any higher. So once I hit that and flatlined it on the little nub, I don't know what I was doing, but it was more than 135.
See, when I said the 1981 Monte Carlo, I figured you'd have a Monte Carlo story.
No, I never had a Monte Carlo. I had that Cougar.
Yeah.
When the Cougar went to the big luxury size there for a few years. And this thing had like a dance floor out in front on the hood. It was so long out in the front of that car.
I remember
Cougar XR7.
When you all lived in Cincinnati, is that when you had that?
I think so, yeah.
I remember we were coming back from a hardware store in Cincinnati and that thing, and you would put a bunch of bags of cement in the trunk.
And I could hardly see out the windshield because it was leaning back so much the hood was up in front of me, and I could hardly see the road.
That's what he said, because that huge hood was sticking up in the air.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to be cool. I was just trying to get cement home.
Yeah, you look like you're driving a lowrider, like you're flipping some switches.
Yeah, it was a lowrider, but it wasn't to be cool.
Hey, you're cool anyway.
Seems weird without the legal briefs in there somewhere.
I know. I couldn't really think of any legal briefs other than the kiting, and we've already talked about that so many times. I was kind of like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, and we didn't go into any detail on the mail fraud or wire fraud or money laundering or anything like that. And that'd be about the only other thing that you could have gone into that we talked about actual charges and stuff.
Yeah, I could have. I just didn't know that's what you're going to talk about.
Well, that's true. Because that wasn't what was going on with old LW.
No, old LW, he was just a good old boy.
Yeah.
Not meaning no harm. Been in trouble with the law since the day he was born.
That's the Dukes of Hazzard.
It is.
Woo!
That'll work. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is poverty in America. I always watch Lester Holt on the NBC Evening News. At the end of each broadcast, the last segment is some type of a feel-good story. It always highlights something positive someone in the world is doing to make this world a better place. It makes you think, like, how come everyone can't be like this? What if this wasn't news, but just simply the way we live our lives, giving others a hand up? I was recently talking with someone about the shape we are in as a country, and I said, how can we consider ourselves the greatest nation on earth when we have the millions of people homeless and hungry that we do? Millions of kids in our country, the greatest country on earth, go to bed not knowing where their next meal will come from. It made me think of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, when Scrooge is confronted by some gentlemen collecting for charity, and the following exchange takes place. Scrooge says, "Are there no prisons?" "Plenty of prisons," said the gentleman. "And the Union workhouses," demanded Scrooge. "Are they still in operation?" "They are still," returned the gentleman. "I wish I could say they were not." "The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor then," said Scrooge. "Both very busy, sir," the gentleman replied. After a pause, Scrooge says, "Oh, I was afraid that, from what you said, at first, that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course. I'm very glad to hear it." The charity gentleman replied, "But many of them will die." Scrooge looks at them and says, "Better they die to decrease the surplus population." The surplus population. That's a hell of a term, and especially a hell of a thought. Yet that is exactly how America seems to regard its less fortunate. Let's close our eyes, and maybe they will go away, or better yet, die, because they are considered surplus. Even if you are cold enough to believe that some of these people are responsible for their own situation, what about their kids? Are they guilty of being born to parents of few means? Why isn't it a national mandate to at least take care of the children? I mean, it should be. Everyone should be taken care of. But why do we think the kids are deserving of such a fate? When the ghost of Christmas Present is visiting Scrooge, at one point he opens his robe, and there stands two children, a boy and a girl. They climb out of his robe from seemingly nowhere. He tells Scrooge, "The boy is called Ignorance, and the girl Want. Beware them both and all of their degree, but most of all, beware the boy." This should serve as a warning to us now. How do you think most of these children will turn out given their dire circumstances? It is our ignorance, driven by want, that the ghost warns us about, not the children's. I have always felt you get out of people what you put into them. So there's that. But back to my Lester Holt news. The segment the other night covered an African-American man, probably in about his late 20s. In the neighborhood where he lived, a family consisting of a single mother and two kids had their apartment burned to the ground, and they had nothing. He didn't know them, but he said he knew what it was like to not know how you were going to make it or provide for your family. While he lived in modest means himself, he gave this family he didn't know his entire paycheck, even while acknowledging that he lives paycheck to paycheck and it would set him back as well. He just felt it was the right thing to do. I will admit that I don't know what the answer is to solve this situation, but I feel the time has come for America to take care of all those that supposedly are part of the greatest nation on earth. After all, the end of our Christmas story says, God bless us, everyone. That's right, everyone. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.